Excuse me.
Sie hören die Sendung Wellenlänge. Vous écoutez la transmission Longueur d'onde. Udite la trasmissione Lunghezza d'onde. You are hearing the transmission called Wavelength.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. That track that we were just listening to was by Jim Nolman from an LP called Playing Music with Animals. The interspecies communication of Jim Nolman with 300 turkeys, 12 wolves, and 20 orca whales. We might hear a bit more of Jim Nolman later. But today's guest is Bill Burns. A welcome return for Bill, who's this, in fact. Good afternoon, Bill.
Good afternoon, William.
I was about to say, this is a return visit. It seems that you were actually on the third programme of Wavelength in November 2005. That was actually I'd only done three programmes, and you were the third one. You then returned again in 2008 to present Bird Radio, Part 1 and Part 2. And that coincided with an exhibition at the ICA at the time. And then in 2009, you did the Dogs, Boats, Airplanes pilot project. So here we are again. Right. You are, of course, the director of the Museum of Safety Gear for Small Animals. And how else should I describe you?
I'm also the artistic director now of the Dogs and Boats and Airplanes Children's Choir. And we have, two iterations of the choir, the 32 voice choir in Toronto. And we're now developing a 100-voice choir in Tasmania, Australia.
My God.
For a festival that will start next summer.
Right. Why Tasmania? How did that come about?
Well, the director of the festival heard about our project, and she was excited enough to engage the Conservatory of Music in Tasmania and So we have several excited parties in Tasmania.
Right. Yeah.
So we're huge in Tasmania.
Actually, strangely enough, I have a listener in Tasmania. I know it was one of the few emails I received was from somebody in Tasmania who said, I like the program. So have you been there yet?
No, I haven't been there yet. I will be going in the new year. So.
Okay. Yeah. Hobart.
Hobart and Launceston.
All right. Hobart's the only one I know in Tasmania.
Yeah. Well, it's the big town.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. But when you came in 2009, the Dogs, Boats, Airplanes was described as a pilot project in collaboration with Mammalian Diving Reflex and Alpha Alternative School Toronto. Mm-hmm. So it's been 3 years sort of in the what we'd call it, production or development.
In development, yes. And then the second phase of the choir, we work with two choirs from different schools, the Lord Lansdowne Public Junior School,
right,
and the, what's the other one called, the Howard Park Public Junior School. They have mostly... I guess it's 6 to 12-year-olds.
Right.
So the choir is really made up of about 8 to 12-year-olds.
Right.
For
okay.
the most part. Yeah.
So what's the sort of motivation behind this project? How did you come to sort of because perhaps you should explain that the it's called Dogs, Boats, Airplanes because the choir has to sound like those things. Is that right?
Yeah. The choir is... it's a non-linguistic choir, so uh-huh. the libretto of the movements on the record are, for instance, all sounds of dogs and boats and airplanes. So the choristers are imitating those sounds. So
right.
that was the kind of challenge to bring that through.
Right.
And also that I should credit the choristers. The choristers are really. They drove the production and the scripting of the libretto.
Mm-hmm.
So it now is really their collaborative work with me and also the choral director.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
But your background can I say you're a visual artist rather than you're not a musician as such?
That's right. I'm not a musician. Really, my background is as a visual artist.
Yeah.
Although I did grow up as a Catholic, and we had a lot of choral work in the family.
Right.
Although I was kicked out of the choir early on.
This is the family choir.
Well, not the family choir, right. But the church choirs
right.
often. Most of my
why were you kicked out?
Apparently.
You couldn't sing.
I couldn't sing.
Okay, right.
But my mother was a soprano and a
all right.
wonderful singer.
Yeah,
and also my sisters were great singers, and they've all recorded. And my brother Terry had several recordings. Recording history is part of the family.
Yeah. So could this be a sort of, is this some sort of revenge for being kicked out?
It could be, I think. I think it's a kind of, it's certainly a kind of phase I'm moving through.
Right.
And I think there's certainly something to be said of what Freud would say about it. I don't know.
Right, okay. So is that when it started in 2009? Is that roughly when it started, or did it start before that?
No, that's roughly when it started. And so we had the first phase, which was basically trying to figure out if it was feasible to, and we thought it was. And then we were invited by Nuit Blanche in Toronto, which is a festival that has funding, and they provided the funding for... the recording in the studio, so
all right.
So we brought the kids into studio, and it was a pretty exciting time for us all, and it helped the choristers focus on the project.
But do you like the idea of does it sort of take you away from being a solo performer, as it were, by collaborating with a choir, it makes you more community orientated or something, or is it just is there a social aspect to this?
There's a social aspect to it. I enjoyed the social aspect to it. I don't know if it's not really a kind of project, a social work kind of project,
right?
But I do believe in that teaching art and culture within our culture is important,
right?
And that's something that's being lost in sort of post-Fordist economies. We're trying to get rid of all the, we're trimming the fat from our budgets and things like that in education, and that's a disaster in terms of a kind of ecology of the soul.
Yeah,
I think.
What about? I was put in mind of is it Tim Rollins and KOS? Mm. I can never remember what KOS stands for. Kids of something or other.
Kids of something.
Yeah, I don't know. But he works with teenagers? Is it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
and that's a sort of much more of a sort of social whatever one wants to like to call it, social improvement agenda or something.
Yeah, I'm not sure what Tim's agenda was, but it certainly was those kind of monikers were put onto it for sure. Like,
right.
But I think that for me, I'm in it because I think art is important, and that art, avant-garde or difficult art like Dada, which we went through a lot of the history of Dada with the choristers and talked about that before we started the project and looked at some scat styles of singing and things like that. So we were just trying to work through the technical challenges.
Right.
But I think those are important things that children and when they're learning, they need to find out about the absurdities and things like that as well. So
yeah.
So that was.
Do they find it baffling, the idea of like making, trying to make a sound like a dog or a boat or an aeroplane? Does it strike them as being absurd to start with?
I think so. Yeah, I think that they understand the sense of absurdity, but also I think that they were intrigued by it and it was, I think the challenge was there. I mean, they were very game for the project.
Right.
Some of the younger ones had more sort of chutzpah in terms of like going for the sounds than the older ones. But eventually the older ones, were more comfortable with the project. But,
yeah. So if I try, how big is the choir in Toronto, you said?
We have 32 members, yeah.
And the Tasmanian one is going to be 100.
Yeah.
And do they all have to concentrate on, they all focus on the idea of making a noise or a sound like another, like a dog or a boat or an aeroplane? How do you instruct them as to what kind of boat or aeroplane it might be? Or
well, for one thing, I start out with an archive. I have an archive of sounds that are recorded, some by me, but mostly grabbed from sound effects albums and websites.
Uh-huh.
And so I have this kind of lexicon of sounds that the choristers listen to, and then generally they have developed the story and libretto by putting together a kind of narrative or sequential series of events. For instance, a dog is walking along the beach. He stops to lap some milk, and then the boat goes by, and the foghorn sounds.
Right.
So that's kind of would be one of the sequences.
So there's a subtext of a narrative usually.
There is. It's not necessarily apparent to the listener,
right?
Because there's no introduction of that linguistically, but it's there. I think maybe we should listen to a couple of a little bit of it, and then see how if we come to any other questions.
Well, what we're gonna do is play the. We'll put one of these records on. rather than the CD, I think. Mm-hmm. You gave me a CD, but let's play the record. And this record, I suppose we should say that this was it's a vinyl LP,
yes,
rather than a CD.
Mm-hmm.
Any reason for that? Why do you just the?
It's kind of my interest in the kind of fetishized object. I'm kind of I'm interested in art and fetishism around art. So for me, that's part of that.
So we're not sure. Do we know if this is side one or side two?
This is side A, I believe. And
okay.
It's the I conceived the sound design here as incidental music for my book, which is called "Dogs in Boats and Airplanes Told in the Form of Ivan the Terrible." So this was a kind of a adjunct conception to the project, but basically it makes good listening whilst you're looking at my book, which is called "Dogs and Boats and Airplanes Told in the Form of Ivan the Terrible."
Thank you. So, Bill, what's the relationship with Ivan the Terrible?
Well, I guess the main relationship for me is kind of an idea that, well, first of all, it's an absurdist proposition to put them together. But secondly, Ivan was a nation builder and a producer and the amalgamator of Russia. So mm-hmm. he was the one that put Russia together for the first time. And to me, this is a kind of, the book, Ivan, The Dogs and Boats and Airplanes, told in the form of Ivan the Terrible. I should just maybe explain how that book works. I took the Sergei Eisenstein film, Ivan the Terrible, part one, because there's actually three parts. Mm. Two were realized and one wasn't. And the first one, Eisenstein won the Stalin Prize for, and the second one he went to the Gulag for.
All right.
And the third one was never realized. But the story is of him putting together the new Russia from a feudal kind of a group of feudal states, and it's considered to be the first construction of the modern nation.
Of the what?
Of the modern nation.
Oh, the modern nation, right.
Yeah. So so that's one interest I had, is that in terms of putting together a book and a story, I wanted to sort of put the idea of that now we have this, we have these abilities to travel at will around the world. And an artist like myself can go around the world taking pictures of dogs and boats and airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a kind of, it's a look at that kind of, to play on how that type of economy operates, the kind of economy that allows for movement of art and of production.
Right.
So we're in an era now that never existed before.
Right. Well, okay, so that gives us boats and airplanes.
Mm.
I think that cars seem to be noticeably lacking, and I can't get the dogs bit.
Well,
although I accept that it's an absurdist proposition, you might not want it to be tied up in an entirely rational way.
Yeah.
But.
Well, the one thing about that I, I'm very interested in dogs and their history, and I think that what's interesting about dogs is that they also are tied up to human history very, very tightly in many respects, and for instance. Dogs also come from Central Africa, like people do, and they have moved around the planet, and large guard dogs mostly came from Northern Africa, like sheep dogs, what they call the. Large guard dogs are usually sheep dogs and some cattle dogs, and they have moved around the world based on their viability as workers and companions. Well, not so much like house companions, but companions to farmers and the like. But basically, as co-workers, they've moved around the world, and then.
We're ready to go. Remember, we're going to have the 10 seconds of silence at the end as well.
So this is the other side, which have a few outtakes.
And two, and three.
So you were saying this is supposed to be, this is a paddle boat they're imitating.
Yes, it's, and on this side of the album we also have the creaking boat, which is a lot of like a larger galley kind
right. of boat. I think I interrupted you at the point about North African guard dogs.
Oh yeah, so in the book I read a couple of years ago by Donna Haraway, she describes the history of some of the large guard dogs, and they moved from, they were like sheep dogs in Northern Africa, and they moved from Egypt to France and Spain, where they became also herders, and they were very successful as herders and the like. But as a result of and they were successful until the Second World War. But so many of the both the humans and the dogs were killed in the I should say the First World War.
Uh-huh.
So many of the dogs and the humans were killed that there was a kind of a loss of memory. Of like, you know, cultural memory that, so the dogs no longer had anyone to train them, and they also didn't know how to behave or how to work anymore,
right?
As herders, so they became basically redundant, and they were replaced by different technologies,
right?
In Southern Europe, so they became more village dogs at that point. And I'm not sure which exact breed it is. They may be Andalusian or something.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, the village dogs didn't have any herding capability at all. But they were still the same dogs. And they a group of do-gooder types in the, on the eastern seaboard of the United States brought over a herd or like a about a dozen of these dogs and started to breed them in Massachusetts.
Oh, right.
And
is that the Newfoundland? No.
I think they might have been called. I'm not sure what they were, but they were guard dogs in the
80s. Okay.
And but they had no purpose in the Eastern in New England or anything either, but they did have a use in Australia at some point. So they were brought into Australia and they were useful in Australia, and then they were recently a group of guard dogs have recently been reintroduced in Montana and I think Idaho. And they are because what they're successful, one of the things that they're successful at doing is keeping away wolves. And that's another reason why they were redundant in Southern Europe, because the wolf population was actually killed by the First World War. Most of the Southern European wolf population died as a result of the First World War, having the last of them in any case. And so that's why.
Why? What did they die of?
They died from as a result of battle or habitat degradation or something like that.
All right.
But in any case, they might have been only a few groups of them left, and
right.
and they didn't survive the war. So in any case, these dogs have they travel the world with us. But what I think is interesting is that they have a there's a kind of symbiosis between the humans and the human history and our teaching to them, and how that is if that chain is broken, then the system collapses. So these dogs no longer were capable of being guard dogs. So, anyways, that's more of an interest and aside than this an explanation of the project.
Okay.
But,
so we're on to side two now of this LP, which is a limited edition, I think.
Yes, it is.
Can you tell me a bit about the edition and so on? When did it come out?
The edition was launched in October.
Mm-hmm.
It's a production of a Big Pond, Small Fish in Toronto. And it's available at Printed Matter in New York, the new museum in New York,
mm-hmm.
Art Metropole in Toronto. And that's all for now, I think.
But what's the edition size, roughly?
The edition size is, there are 100 in the regular edition,
uh-huh.
and they're signed, and there's 20 artist proofs, and there's 25 in the special edition.
Yeah.
The special edition, besides the beautiful label on the regular edition, the special edition has a poster from a series of works that I made, and the posters are based on images of Popova and Rodchenko.
Right.
But I've replaced the again where there were sometimes tractors and trucks and pictures of Lenin. I've replaced them with pictures of dogs and airplanes and boats.
Right.
So
we have two of these in the studio, one of which is mine, I hope.
There you go.
How much do I owe you?
I believe the special editions are about £60 each, and the regular editions are about £16 or £17 each.
Right.
Yeah.
Will they be available in England anywhere? I mean, do you have just an outlet? Or?
I don't have an outlet in England, but I would be interested. Is Resonance Radio interested in selling?
I don't know. We'd have to take that up with the management.
Yeah.
But you could possibly do it through Rough Trade. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Possibly they might. They might sell it.
Yeah.
It's the sort of thing I mean, you can buy artist records there occasionally.
Okay. Very good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're on your way to you're passing through London. You're here for a week.
That's right. And
you said something about a manuscript. You're on your way to do a manuscript somewhere.
Yeah, I'm working I'm finishing a manuscript that I started several years ago, in fact, and it's gotten away on me a little bit. So I'll be wrestling with it in the. In the mountains in Finland.
Oh, right.
And,
okay. So you're on your way to Finland now?
Yes.
And
do
you have some kind of, what do you call it, a stipend or something?
Yeah, it's a fellowship by called the Cone Fellowship, and they invite artists and writers to come and work, and they pay us a salary.
So oh, right.
Kind of,
wow.
It's a miracle.
Okay. Why Finland?
Well, mostly because that's where the money is.
Really? The money's in Finland.
Well, the money that they're
paying
me.
The only people left with any money.
Okay. That's it. Well, I do find the Nordic countries fairly generous with the arts, and and they haven't cut back as much in their support for the arts.
Okay.
That's one of the reasons why I tend to be big in Scandinavia, as well as Tasmania, and now Finland, which is not Scandinavian, but close enough.
Is it not?
No, I
would always have thought of it as part of Scandinavia.
No, Scandinavia is a language group, so they tend to be from Sweden to Iceland are Scandinavians,
okay,
including Denmark.
Right.
But.
Well, you brought something else in with you, which I'm now going to open, or try and open, if I can. Oh yeah. So this is a set of books, three books and an audio CD about plants and animals and war by the artist Bill Burns. A boxed set edition comprised of three books and an audio compact disc. So there's three very small booklets in a card slipcase. And this one is signed Bill Burns, Artist Proof, number 7 of 10. This is published by Walter Koenig?
Yes, it is.
Right, or distributed by them, or both, I suppose.
It's published, it's a bit of a complicated story, like artist books sometimes are.
Right.
The original book in the series was published by Walter Koenig. It was called Bird Radio.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second book in the series was published by the ICA in London. It was called 0800 O Flora O Fauna.
Mm-hmm.
And the third book is called Boiler Suits for Primates.
Right.
And it was published by YYZ in Toronto. And but then the boxed edition was in the plans from the beginning, and Walter Koenig mm-hmm. Took on the boxed edition as
right.
a project. So
what's Boiler Suits for Primates? Can you say something about that?
Boiler Suits for Primates is the third in the series. The first one describes the birds of Afghanistan and ancient Mesopotamia, more or less. The second one describes the plants of those same regions.
Mm-hmm.
And the third one is a guide to everything that you get when you arrive at the prison camps in Guantanamo Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I call it the guide, a primate's guide.
Mm-hmm.
That's the subtitle for the project.
Right.
And it's a guide to the music that's played to prisoners at high decibels.
Uh-huh.
And also all the clothes. So it gives you drawings of each of the whole outfit that you get when you arrive at the camps, and it tells you how what kind of food you can expect to eat.
Well. So this comes with an audio CD.
Yes.
In the book.
Mm-hmm.
A mini CD.
Mm-hmm.
Which is called Bird Songs for Afghanistan, Series 1, Series 2, and Fauna, Flora, Excerpt 1, Excerpt 2. We could play some of this.
Mm-hmm.
I'll put it on there. Things. We've now come to the end of the vinyl LP, so let's go with it.
My bird is called a house sparrow. The Latin name for it is Passer domesticus. Sparrows came to the New World from Europe. Groups of them were let go in San Francisco and Salt Lake City. Now sparrows live all over, from Panama to northern British Columbia. In the wintertime, it lives in towns and cities. The top of its head is gray, its eyes are black. The side of its head is white. Sparrows have a white belly with bluish-gray stripes and a black beak. The sparrow song sounds like this.
My bird is called the nightingale, and its Latin name is Lucinia megahintrus, and it sings like this.
Is called the gray cuckoo. Its scientific name, Cucullus canorus. The gray cuckoo is a blue-gray bird with white and little stripes underneath. It hangs out in wastelands and marshes. The gray cuckoo has a cousin called the black-billed cuckoo. It lives in Canada. Some people call cuckoos rain crows because they call out more before it rains. The cuckoo sounds like this.
You'll notice the birds are endemic to Canada in this sequence.
Are they?
And,
okay.
What I've found in the research with the students at Alpha Alternative School who did this project,
mm-hmm.
That the same birds, in fact, share some of the same birds share the habitat that stretches all the way from Alaska to northern India,
mm-hmm.
and other birds.
The name of my bird is Jay. Its Latin name is Gorilla.
Another group of
and they're very beautiful.
Another bit of information was that the bird calls that we had those rudimentary musical instruments that they're using to make the sounds.
Mm.
The same bird calls could make the sound of a bird like a starling or a bird that's endemic to Afghanistan, for instance,
mm-hmm.
And one that's endemic to Canada. And they might be different birds, but the bird call is the same call.
Oh, right. So when you say bird calls, these are sort of devices?
Yeah, they're little, kind of musical, rudimentary devices that make sounds, but you have to be fairly good at playing them to make them sound.
Oh, I see. So they don't make the sound automatically. You have to adjust what you do to it.
You have to play it
like an instrument.
You have to play it like an instrument.
What is it, like a little wind instrument sort of?
Yeah, they're like little wind instruments that I have. I put pumps on most of them. They're not made by me. They're ready-made, but I added the kind of bladders, rubber bladders and the like to allow people to use them without having to suck and blow on them.
Right. And what are they made for?
They have two purposes. One is to attract birds. They're kind of like more for understanding and research of birds. And the other one is for hunting and killing birds.
Right. So the same device serves two different purposes.
Yes, it can.
But so they lure birds towards you then,
yeah,
or something? They attract birds.
They attract birds, and then if they're a hunter, you might kill them.
Right. Okay.
A long time ago, some people put about 100 starlings in Central Park in New York City. They also put other birds from the plays of William Shakespeare into the park. The starlings did really well. Now they're all over. A bunch of starlings together sound like this.
Is the woodcock, and its scientific name is the Scolopax rusticola. It has a fat body and round wings, and it looks sort of like an owl, except owls don't have long beaks, and it likes to stay secret, and it sounds like this.
So again, with this project, you're working with children.
Mm-hmm.
Bird is called a common red chink.
It's interesting because your earlier projects were what should we call it? Protective clothing for small animals.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you're kind of interested in, I suppose, miniaturization of all sorts, really. I mean, these are miniature people and. You went for the protective gear only for small animals, mm-hmm. so you wouldn't have come up with a jacket for a wolf, for example.
No, not likely. I think I don't really think of. It's a nice illusion, the idea that children are miniature, but
are they not?
Well, they are small, yes, smaller than us. But I think what was interesting to me about it was just. That I liked the culture that I saw in the children that I was working with, including my daughters who were at the same school at that time. So I was sort of, I thought, you know, it was a really interesting kind of texture to their life and to their, like, a little culture. And I thought that it would be...
But it is always smallness with you, isn't it? Is it because, is there a vulnerability there, or just...
It could be, like, I do think, yeah, it's true, I have an attraction to that...
my bird is the
Galinigo. To the idea that...
or more commonly called
maybe
the snipe.
Things that are vulnerable, or people that are vulnerable.
Yeah.
That could be. I never analyzed it that way.
Yeah, right.
It sounds like this. It's called the blue tit. In Latin, it's pars cruellus. Blue tits eat more than they weigh every day. They eat lots of insects in the summertime, and in the winter, they eat fat and seeds that they find in the gardens. Blue
okay,
tits
well,
are strange.
We're gonna, we'll move the CD on to track three or four. Now, just fade this out.
These sounds are from my project at the Institute for Contemporary Art in London in
2008.
Yeah, it was a telephone answering service.
If you want to learn about our bird radio program or about boiler suits for primates, press 2. If you want to learn about how you can help preserve threatened plants, press 3. If you would like to skip to our sales items, press 4. To return to the main menu at any time, press 9. Advanced industrialism, climate change and war have put plant life at risk around the world. Our floral protection program has three options: to help rebuild stocks of species at risk by sponsoring proxy flora planting, press 1. To help rebuild stocks from seeds, press 2. To participate in one of our other flora programs, press 3. When coalition forces accidentally destroyed the National Farm Seed Bank at Abu Ghraib, Iraq, it was feared that the ancient history of Mesopotamian agriculture would be lost. Fortunately, the occupying government passed an order to enable corporations to fill the gap. To learn more about the new seed practices in Iraq, and what you can do to help, press 1. To help preserve plant life from other parts of Central Asia, press 2. To return to the main menu at any time, press 9. In an effort to ensure a secure and bountiful food supply for posterity, the post-war administration of Iraq passed Order 81, stating that farmers shall be prohibited from reusing protected seed varieties. To learn more about how the Monsanto and Dow Chemical Corporations are helping, press 1. To learn how to order a protected variety, press 2. Protected seed varieties not only resist disease but are able to grow where Roundup and other herbicides have been used. To order instructions about how to procure a sample of herbicide-resistant grain, press 1. To learn more about how chemical technological research helps get food where it is most needed.
What is this process, Bill? What's happening with this strange voice on this phone thing?
Well, that's Victoria. She's Macintosh Computer's, one of Macintosh Computer's voices. And so I was able to enter in text into the program, and she was able to recite the answers to the system. So this allowed us to make a very large telephone answering tree kind of service. And people could find their way through the system quite and negotiate it quite easily.
Right.
But that's Victoria's voice there, and so all we have to do is enter in the text, and it plays automatically.
Right.
But you know, she misses the odd
So now we've gone back to...
I don't know how that happened.
Groups of them were let go in San Francisco and Salt Lake City.
Now Sparrow... He's gone back to track one. That must have been the end of the... Well, that's all right.
Well,
so we should say the LP, which has just come out, really.
That's right.
You just launched it at Printed Matter in New York. There's Dogs, Boats and Airplanes, vinyl LP, limited edition. And that is seemingly only available from Printed Matter at the moment in New York.
Well, yes, you can get it at Printed Matter in New York or the New Museum in New York. And Printed Matter has an excellent mail order service, so you can look up printedmatter.org or printedmatter.com, and they'll help you. The vinyl LPs, the regular editions, are going at $30 US, and the special editions are $100 US. So.
Okay. Well, thank you very much to Bill Burns for coming in. You've been listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM. And we can, well, I'll play out with... half a track from Playing Music with Animals, the Interspecies Communication of Jim Nolman. And this track is Music to Eat Thanksgiving Dinner by Three Flute Players and 300 Turkeys.
It's called the Gray Cuckoo. Its scientific name, Cucullus canorus. The Gray Cuckoo is a big gray cuckoo. Thank you.